Welcome to Rural EdMed. I am Serena Wilson, an acute care nurse practitioner, and I will be speaking about alcohol withdrawal syndrome. Alcohol has been used as long as there has been recorded history, for medicinal purposes, celebrations, and to induce relaxation. It has been involved in numerous religious ceremonies and rituals over the years. It was used in ancient Egypt and Greece and China and India as early as 7000 BC. Vineyards were the source of livelihood, and sometimes workers were even paid in alcohol. In America, a law was passed to prohibit this type of payment in 1672, and the law actually resulted in a labor strike. Native American cultures were making alcoholic beverages as early as 200 BC. They were made with bark, fermented juice, honey, and maize. Rome had their god of wine. Alcoholism must have existed from very early times, although it was not spoken of directly. Timeless warnings of the dangers of drunkenness appear repeatedly throughout history. It wasn't until the late 1900s that we began to speak of addiction as a biological disease. Ethyl alcohol, or ethanol, is the active ingredient found in alcoholic beverages. Upon oral ingestion, it is first metabolized to acetaldehyde in a reaction catalyzed by alcohol dehydrogenase, or ADH. ADH has a high degree of genetic variability in functioning, which may explain how different people can drink the same amount of alcohol but achieve a different level of intoxication. Acetaldehyde is then metabolized to acetate via catalyzation by acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, or ALDH. The majority of metabolism takes place in the liver, although it starts in the stomach. The stomach contains ADH to start the process, but there is a much lower concentration of this substance here in females compared to males, making females much more susceptible to the effects of alcohol. Alcoholism as a biological disease is poorly understood. It is believed to have something to do with the mesolimbic dopaminergic system, especially the ventral tegmental area of the brain. When receptors on the ventral tegmental area are stimulated, dopamine is released. These specific receptors are glutamatergic and are stimulated in response to alcohol, methamphetamine, and cocaine use, gambling, certain foods, and pretty much anything that a person could be addicted to. The dopamine release acts on the nucleus accumbens and striatum of the forebrain to induce reward memories and pleasant associations. There is likely a genetic component in determining who will respond this way to certain substances, but this is the brain area activated when we do or take something that feels good, whether it be charity work or narcotic use. During abstinence, the receptor stimulus is removed, resulting in craving. As related by Charles O'Brien, a neuroscientist specializing in addiction, at a neuronal level, this compulsive relapse suggests plasticity, a memory trace. No treatment has ever been theorized, however, that could selectively erase addiction memories while not impairing new memory formation. Indeed, current alcoholism treatment focuses on avoidance, triggers, and even pharmacologic therapy to cause sickness when alcohol is ingested. These treatments often fail and do not address the motivations behind addictive use, namely the memory trace that compels an addict to use again. So why does chronic alcohol use, with abrupt cessation, cause the constellation of symptoms we know as alcohol withdrawal? The human body's function is to maintain homeostasis at all costs. It maintains body temperature, pH, and electrolytes within a very narrow range. It responds to outlying values by taking action to correct those values back to the normal range. The body does the same with any chemical taken in that is capable of interacting with any of the body's receptors. Activation of receptors occurs through their interactions with chemicals, drugs, intrinsically produced hormones, neurotransmitters, and other substances. Receptors can be modified in three ways to maintain homeostasis in the presence of excessive or inadequate activation or stimulation. Increased numbers of receptors can be synthesized or downregulated through destructive processes. Receptors can be recruited from other areas to the synapse where the given reaction is to take place. The receptors can be modified in ways that can make them more or less responsive to a given stimulant. Alcohol is thought to exert its effects partially through interaction with N-methyl-D-aspartate or NAMDA receptors and gamma-aminobutyric acid or GABA receptors. Stimulation of a receptor can either increase or decrease a response. These particular receptors are found throughout the central nervous system and are intrinsically stimulated by the neurotransmitters glutamate and GABA, respectively. GABA receptors are major inhibitory players in the central nervous system. The effect of their stimulation is highlighted by the extrinsic drugs that stimulate them. These include benzodiazepines, barbiturates, general anesthetics, and of course, alcohol. Less than 3 alcoholic beverages can potentiate GABA receptors in the CNS, resulting in sedation, memory impairment, decreased attention, a raised seizure threshold, and anxiolysis. The body's response to receptor stimulation with alcohol is immediate but reversible downregulation of the numbers of GABA receptors both extrasynaptic and postsynaptically. Having less receptors means that extrinsic and intrinsic sources of activation are less likely to actually result in receptor activation. Reversing this downregulation often takes several weeks. Alcohol decreases the response of NAMDA receptors, which are excitatory in nature. NAMDA is the natural receptor for the excitatory neurotransmitter glutamate. Glutamate is involved in the sensation of pain, learning and memory, generation of breathing and locomotion rhythms, and neural plasticity or changes in neural pathways and synapses. Alcohol is an antagonist of NAMDA receptors. Through this antagonism, it exerts its effects of pain relief, drowsiness, slow thought processes, decreased memory, and sometimes respiratory depression. The body responds to the chronic inhibition of NAMDA receptors by trying to restore homeostasis via compensatory increases in the number of NAMDA receptors at the area of effect and also by increasing the sensitivity of those receptors to glutamate. The down and up regulation of various receptors in response to an extrinsic drug is the physiological basis for drug and alcohol tolerance. If you repeatedly put something in your body that stimulates a receptor, your body will decrease numbers of that receptor, making it so that your body needs more and more of that substance to obtain the same effect. This is also the basis for withdrawal. It's why meth addicts suffer severe depression and lethargy when abstinent. To withdraw the inciting substance in the setting of decreased numbers of receptors leads to a severe deficiency of a given stimulation. Sudden cessation of alcohol results in withdrawal of inhibition of NAMDA receptors in the setting of having too many and much more sensitive NAMDA receptors, and withdrawal of GABA stimulation in the setting of having too few and more insensitive GABA receptors. The end result is excitotoxicity. This can result in increased psychomotor agitation, hallucinations, anxiety, neuronal degeneration and cell death, and even seizures. Symptoms of alcohol withdrawal can start as early as 8 hours following an abrupt decrease in blood alcohol levels. Blood alcohol levels do not have to be zero, just decreased from usual levels. Symptoms peak within 72 hours and often do not resolve for 5 to 7 days, or even longer if a person develops delirium tremens. Hyperadrenergic symptoms of alcohol withdrawal include tachycardia, hypertension, fever, psychomotor agitation, increased myocardial risk, arrhythmias, increased myocardial oxygen consumption, and increased circulating catecholamines. Alcohol withdrawal is defined per the ICD-10 guidelines to include at least three of the following symptoms. Tremor. Now, tremor can be faked in arms, but it is helpful to look at eyelids and in the tongue, as faking of this symptom is much harder to do. Diaphoresis, nausea and vomiting, tachycardia or hypertension, psychomotor hyperactivity, headache, insomnia, malaise, hallucinations or delusions, seizures. These must occur following cessation or reduction of alcohol and cannot be attributed to another mental or physical condition. Delirium tremens is when these symptoms are also accompanied by hallucinations, confusion, and sensory disturbances. A person is more likely to have delirium tremens if they have CWAS scores greater than 15, they have had delirium tremens or withdrawal seizures in the past, older patients, or patients with medical comorbidities or electrolyte imbalance. Approximately 1-4% of hospitalized patients in alcohol withdrawal will die, usually as a result of cardiac arrhythmias, complications of seizures, or hyperthermia. It is important to understand that delirium can occur in the setting of conditions unrelated to alcohol. There are two major types of delirium. The first is one consisting of hyperactive symptoms, such as hallucinations, agitation, and combativeness. This is the most common form occurring from alcohol withdrawal. The second consists of hypoactive symptoms, such as decreased arousal and the appearance of excessive sedation. When this occurs in relation to alcohol withdrawal, it is associated with a poor prognosis. Patients with delirium can present with one of these types or fluctuate between both. All types result in an intentional deficit and confusion, often with interruption of normal sleep-wake cycles. Only about 5-10% of all alcohol withdrawal results in delirium tremens. It is unknown why this is. One theory is the kindling effect, which says that the more times a person has withdrawn in the past, the more likely they are to progress to the delirium tremens. Prior response to alcohol withdrawal is the only risk factor for delirium tremens and seizure, and this response has been shown to get worse over time. Because of this, withdrawing a patient should not be a decision that is taken lightly. It is not a benign therapy and should not be attempted in a patient who does not desire to stop drinking. There is a mortality rate associated with alcohol withdrawal. People die from associated arrhythmias, seizures, from complications such as aspiration pneumonia, and exacerbations of their chronic comorbidities. Unfortunately, we as healthcare workers do not always have a choice of whether or not to withdraw patients. Many patients have symptoms or conditions that render them incapable of taking an alcohol, or have conditions such as a GI bleed for which alcohol is absolutely contraindicated. The standard of care for treatment in the past was a fixed tapering dose of benzodiazepines. Studies in the 1990s and early 2000s have shown that symptom-triggered dosing results in fewer doses of benzos given, less frequent dosing, shorter treatment time, and no difference in complications. Later studies showed that symptom-triggered dosing with aggressive titration results in a decreased need for mechanical ventilation by approximately 50%, decreased ICU length of stay, decreased average drug doses used, and surprisingly, a decreased prevalence of new pneumonia. There is no one particular symptom-based tool that has been shown to be superior to others, but the Clinical Institute Withdrawal Assessment for Alcohol Scale Revised, or CWA, is the most commonly used scale for symptom-triggered dosing of medications for alcohol withdrawal. It is a 10-item screening tool with questions based on the DSM-8 criteria for diagnosis of alcohol withdrawal syndrome. The Richmond Agitation Score, or RAS, and the Sedation Agitation Score, or SAS, have also been used for this purpose. The RAS score can be used in nonverbal patients and has excellent inter-rater reliability. The scale is simple to use. One simply assigns a number to a patient from plus floor or combative all the way down to -5 or unarousable. A goal score of 0 to -1 is desirable in the treatment of alcohol withdrawal, which correlates with alert and calm to drowsy. The SAS score allows the rater to assign a numerical score based on the description of a given patient as well. The score goes from 1 to 7, or unarousable, to dangerous agitation, pulling at lines, tubes, crawling over the bed rail, striking a staff, thrashing. A goal SAS score of 3 to 4, which corresponds to sedated but wakens to verbal stimuli, simple commands but drifts off frequently to calm and cooperative. Again, this scale is quite easy to use and provides descriptors of common situations with a hospitalized patient. Both the RAS and SAS scores were developed to assess delirium symptoms, especially of ICU patients who are frequently unable to communicate verbally. They work quite well for nonverbal withdrawing patients as well. A 2015 retrospective cohort review looking at methods to manage severe alcohol withdrawal found that 16 different medications and 74 different medication combinations were used in the treatment of 184 patients determined to have resistant alcohol withdrawal. This same review pointed out the wide variability in treatment strategies with relatively few evidence-based guidelines. The medications with evidence to back them, such as phenobarbital for resistant symptoms, was more infrequently used unless a toxicology consult was obtained. Other drugs, such as Haldol, in which limited data on its use in refractory withdrawal actually suggests harm, were used routinely. Pharmacological treatment included various benzos, central alpha agonists, clonidine and Presidex, ketamine, phenobarbital, propofol, Haldol, and other atypical antipsychotics. Benzodiazepines are the oldest and still most frequently used medications in the treatment of alcohol withdrawal syndrome. The first benzo, approved by the FDA in 1960, was Librium. It was discovered by a Dr. Leo Sternberg. He worked for Hoffman LaRoche Laboratories and spent his time there trying to synthesize new drugs from compounds he had created in the late 1930s while a postdoctoral student in Poland. He ended up creating over 40 new compounds, all of which were pharmacologically inert. The Librium compound, then known as Rho5-0690, was not tested immediately. When he left the lab 18 months later, an assistant discovered this compound in a storage and asked if it should be tested. Librium was found to induce anxiolytic effects in mice and caused muscle relaxation in cats. This was followed by human trials in neuropsychology patients. Later, it was discovered that benzos could also be used to treat seizures and withdrawal symptoms. Benzos act at the GABA receptors and augment the chloride channel opening and influx that results in the hyperpolarization necessary for inhibitory action. Benzos do not bind at the GABA binding site, but rather to a benzodiazepine binding site between subunits of the GABA receptor, thus enhancing the effect of GABA already present. Because they tend to stimulate GABA receptors at the level of the brainstem, much more so than in the brain, they are less sedating and leave most cognitive function intact. Unfortunately, their effects on the very receptors that are downregulated with chronic alcohol use makes it so that often very large doses are required, and sometimes alcohol symptoms are completely refractory to this drug. The use of benzos in the treatment of alcohol withdrawal syndrome is the most well-supported therapy in the literature. A 1997 meta-analysis of pharmacological withdrawal treatment therapies looked at a total of 65 prospective controlled trials comparing benzos to placebo, other drugs, and other drugs, and comparing long- and short-acting benzos. Benzos were better at preventing delirium and seizures. Long- and short-acting benzos seemed equally effective at treating withdrawal symptoms. Long-acting benzos prevented seizures more effectively, but led to excessive sedation more often. Onset of action for different benzodiazepines also had significance. Those with longer times till onset of action had less abuse potential themselves. Librium is one such drug. Both diazepam and lorazepam have more rapid onset of action and thus higher abuse potentials. Benzodiazepine-resistant withdrawal is defined as requiring greater than 40 milligrams of Valium in 1 hour or an equivalent dose of another benzo. These patients have an exceptionally high risk of requiring mechanical ventilation and acquiring nosocomial pneumonia. A benzodiazepine escalation procedure consists of administering a bolus dose of 10 to 100 milligrams diazepam every 15 minutes or 2 to 16 milligrams lorazepam every 20 to 30 minutes in an escalating dose fashion until the patient achieves adequate sedation. It is supported by a single-center study of 95 patients admitted for alcohol withdrawal only. 54 of these patients were treated in a standard fashion. 41 were treated according to a protocol of increasing doses of diazepam with the addition of phenobarbital if still refractory. The first group of patients were looked at retrospectively before the new guidelines were instituted. The 41 patients were looked at after the change in policy. As expected, the second group had much higher individual and total doses of benzodiazepines given. Strangely, they had a lower incidence of needing mechanical ventilation and a trend towards a lower rate of nosocomial pneumonia. While one could argue that advances in alcohol withdrawal care might have been made between the periods before and after the escalating dose protocol were instituted, it definitely shows that these doses were unlikely to cause harm. Some clinicians have suggested the use of alcohol to treat or ameliorate symptoms of alcohol withdrawal. Studies regarding the use of alcohol to control withdrawal symptoms show conflicting results and are often not generalizable due to heterogeneity in study design. Some have used a blood alcohol goal of 2 to 12 milligrams per deciliter. Others use a downward titrating dose of IV alcohol. Most are case reports. Then there are the ethical considerations. Continued alcohol can lead to GI bleed, hepatic encephalopathy, and interfere with healing. Blood alcohol levels can be difficult to monitor. Many institutions do not carry IV ethanol. A 2013 pilot study looked at alcohol and Ativan versus Ativan alone in acute MI patients expected to withdraw. The sample size of 57 was too small to detect a difference. All the patients reported 3+ drinks per day and had a CAGE score of 2 or greater. Alcohol was administered at 50% their reported home dose of daily, given as beer or vodka, oral or per NG tube. The dose was progressed to 100% daily alcohol plus Ativan 2 milligrams every 12 hours or more if they still were not at a goal level of sedation. If symptoms continued to escalate, a loading procedure was done in both the Ativan and Ativan plus alcohol groups. They found no difference in mortality, withdrawal symptoms, cardiac damage, or complications such as self-extubation and dangerous arrhythmias. There was a trend in the alcohol group towards fewer feeding tube dislodgements, less agitation, and shorter stays both in CCU and in a hospital, but these results did not reach significance. Ethical concerns of providers and families did lead to early removal from the alcohol arm in this study. A 2007 study compared alcohol withdrawal treatment outcomes before and after institution of a new protocol using intravenous ethanol and blood alcohol levels in surgical patients. There were 92 patients in the usual care arm and 68 in the IV ethanol arm. They found that patients treated with IV ethanol required a shorter duration of treatment, had decreased failure rates and surprisingly had an increased referral rates to the substance abuse clinic. A 2002 study looked at postoperative patients in the ICU with alcohol withdrawal syndrome treated with intravenous alcohol and found a high failure rate regardless of the method of dosing. There have been several small-scale retrospective studies that show ethanol treatment to result in progression of withdrawal symptoms or complications. Most of these have sample sizes of 10 to 20 patients, however. Barbiturates such as phenobarbital increase binding at benzo and GABA A binding sites, resulting in depressed sensory awareness, decreased motor activity and alertness, drowsiness, dose-dependent respiratory depression, and anticonvulsive effects. They are used off-label in the treatment of alcohol withdrawal. Theoretically, using a drug to increase binding at sites that have been down-regulated makes sense. Phenobarbital, in particular, has a very low potential for abuse. Unfortunately, this drug is not particularly safe to use as an outpatient, especially when combined with alcohol. It could cause respiratory depression. A 2013 prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study compared a single dose of 10 milligrams per kilogram in 100 milliliters of saline versus 100 milliliters of saline in benzo-refractory alcohol withdrawal in the ED. There were 51 patients in each arm. They found that patients receiving phenobarbital were less likely to be admitted to the ICU and had no more adverse events. Propofol is a general anesthetic as well as activates GABA receptors and antagonizes NAMDA receptors. Propofol has been used for many years as an induction agent for intubation and sedation during mechanical ventilation. It can cause hypotension, respiratory depression, and a syndrome leading to renal failure and cardiovascular collapse known as propofol-related infusion syndrome. The research results involving propofol have not been particularly promising. A 2012 study determined similar duration of withdrawal, length of stay, and ventilator days between benzodiazepine and propofol-treated patients. A 2014 research paper compared the use of a benzo alone or benzo and propofol in benzodiazepine-resistant alcohol withdrawal and found that the propofol group had a longer duration of withdrawal and more complications, such as seizures, hallucinations, and hypotension. Propofol is a good, well-supported agent in sedation during mechanical ventilation. It is lipophilic, so it easily crosses membranes and is eliminated quickly, causing a short duration of action. It can be titrated to sedation level. It can also be used with benzodiazepines. Unfortunately, there's currently little evidence to support its use solely for alcohol withdrawal syndrome. Dexmedetomidate is a centrally acting alpha agonist used to blunt the sympathetic hyperactivity associated with alcohol withdrawal syndrome. It is 8 times more potent than the other commonly used central alpha blocker, clonidine, and much shorter acting. It leads to anxiolysis and analgesia. Adverse side effects can include bradycardia and hypotension. It does not have the adverse effect of respiratory depression, however, making it a very useful agent in non-intubated patients. There is very little information about the use of this drug in the form of clinical trials. Most of the data we have is retrospective and small scale. Most studies suggest lower dosage needs of benzos while on this medication and decreased CWAS scores when compared to benzos alone. Some studies directly contradict this, suggesting higher benzo needs. It has been suggested that doses higher than approved for sedation purposes may be beneficial in these patients, but there are no studies to evaluate this. The results of the first prospective double-blind randomized control study evaluating dexmedetomidate use for alcohol withdrawal is currently underway and results are expected to be published in 2017. Clonidine has been used in a few small-scale studies and has been shown to help with mild to moderate withdrawal symptoms, but does not seem to affect the incidence of seizures or delirium, similar to dexmedetomidate. Clonidine has been shown to decrease autonomic symptoms of withdrawal, such as hypertension and tachycardia, and is generally only recommended as an adjunctive therapy. Similarly, beta blockers are sometimes used to decrease autonomic manifestations of alcohol withdrawal. Unfortunately, these drugs do not address this cause of symptoms, mainly the central nervous system hyperactivity. They are also suggested as an adjunctive therapy only. Other adjunctive agents include phenothiazines, haloperidol, and other atypical antipsychotics. All of these medications have very little, if any, effect on the incidence of withdrawal-associated delirium and seizures. Haldol actually lowers the seizure threshold and prolongs the QT interval, potentially increasing the already high risk of cardiac dysrhythmias. There has been some recent interest in pure GABA B agonist baclofen for treatment of alcohol withdrawal symptoms. Because it affects GABA receptors but not the GABA A receptors downregulated by chronic alcohol use, theoretically its use would result in less resistance and a cross-tolerance. A 2011 study randomized approximately 30 patients with a CWAS score greater than 11 to receive baclofen in addition to Ativan. Patients receiving baclofen were much less likely to need escalating doses of subsequent Ativan. What set this study apart from the usual alcohol withdrawal literature is that they actually used sick inpatients. They gave baclofen 10 milligrams 3 times a day, or placebo, in addition to the usual CWA-dosed Ativan. Those on baclofen had a reduction in high-dose Ativan use. Unfortunately, this is a new therapy for this indication, and it needs further research. Chronic alcohol use causes other problems beyond what is experienced during the acute intoxication and/or withdrawal phases. Carl Wernicke first described polioencephalitis hemorrhagica superioris in 1881, not as a consequence of alcoholism, but from malnutrition. A seamstress developed pyloric stenosis as a result of a suicide attempt after ingesting sulfuric acid. The pyloric stenosis caused severe malnutrition and later some neurological complications. This constellation of symptoms would later become known as Wernicke's encephalopathy. Wernicke's encephalopathy is a neurological dysfunction caused by brain depletion of vitamin B1 or thiamine. It is seen in chronic alcoholism as well as anorexia, fasting, starvation, wasting diseases such as AIDS, gastrointestinal surgery, excessive vomiting, or dialysis. Total body thiamine requirements are dependent on metabolic demand. Thiamine is required for the metabolism and use of glucose, which is especially important in the central nervous system because the brain uses glucose almost exclusively to meet its energy needs. The high metabolic needs of the brain in the setting of thiamine deficiency results in the breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, excitotoxicity, and increased reactive oxygen species production. The brain does not store energy and is then unable to utilize the glucose already present, so this state rapidly leads to encephalopathy. High glucose intake stimulates needs for higher doses of thiamine and can precipitate further decline. Korsakoff syndrome, a sequela of untreated or inadequately treated Wernicke's, can lead to permanent dementia-like dysfunction of cognitive processes. It is difficult to predict who will end up with Wernicke's Korsakoff syndrome and who will be able to tolerate the deficiencies associated with chronic alcoholism. There may be a genetic component. Co-deficiency of magnesium also predisposes to this condition. Magnesium is needed to utilize the thiamine that is available. Long-standing and a poor nutritional status may predispose. Poor absorption of nutrients certainly contributes and seems to escalate in a circular fashion. Those with thiamine deficiency are less able to absorb thiamine that is taken in. There is decreased storage in the liver. Wernicke's encephalopathy causes a triad of symptoms. The first and most obvious is encephalopathy, which may include confusion, inattentiveness, and eventually coma. The second is oculomotor dysfunction. This may manifest as nystagmus, gaze palsy, or pupillary abnormalities. The final component of the triad is gait ataxia. This is usually the result of vestibular dysfunction. Symptoms may not all appear. Patients may only have one or two major symptoms of the three. Those with Wernicke's encephalopathy may also have characteristic changes of the brain. The third and fourth ventricles and sulci usually enlarge with chronic alcohol use and often shrink with abstinence. Those who have had a prior episode of Wernicke's tend to have much smaller mammillary bodies and lesions of the anterior thalamus. Mammillary bodies are involved in recall memory. Mammillary atrophy also occurs in Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, and chronically hypoxic conditions such as sleep apnea. Chronic alcoholics also have accelerated subcortical white matter loss that is potentially reversible with sobriety. Those with Wernicke's from any cause tend to have cerebellar lesions and degeneration. This is probably the source of the gait ataxia, tremor, blurred vision, vertigo, and incoordination that becomes permanent over time. As Wernicke's progresses to Korsakoff's, there is a destruction of mammillary bodies, demyelination, gliosis, and neuron loss. Korsakoff's presents as anterograde and retrograde amnesia with sparing of remote memory. These people will suffer a lack of interest, enthusiasm, or concern. Many confabulate to hide memory problems. Most are unaware of their deficits. The diagnosis is clinical. Tests are time-consuming and not diagnostic. One can have a deficiency of thiamine with normal laboratory thiamine levels. These syndromes can result from a deficiency of cofactors or other inability to use body thiamine. Many labs are incapable of providing efficient serum thiamine values. The other issue is that thiamine deficiency can rapidly progress to morbidity and mortality. A clinical diagnosis is having two of the following four conditions: nutritional deficiency, ocular signs, ataxia, and mental status changes. The most common inciting factor is infection, with the resultant increase in metabolic needs leading to relative nutritional deficiency. It can also occur in the setting of prolonged glucose loading. The treatment of Wernicke's and Korsakoff's is to replace thiamine. The IV route is preferred because of unpredictable oral absorption. Confusion usually resolves in days to weeks. Ataxia resolves after 2 weeks. Ocular dysfunction may take hours to days or may be permanent. There are no studies to suggest an optimal dose. Any dose between 100 and 500 milligrams daily has been used. Studies do show that thiamine has a short half-life, so dosing may need to be 2 to 3 times a day in the acute phase. Side effects are uncommon. Thiamine appears to be safe in high or low doses. Electrolyte and acid-base imbalances are also common in alcohol withdrawal. Not only do alcoholics tend to consume the majority of their calories in the form of alcohol, with resulting severe nutritional deficits, but their kidneys also tend to eliminate much higher than normal amounts of magnesium, phosphorus, and calcium. These changes in renal tubular excretion are independent of renal function and usually disappear within 4 weeks of alcohol abstinence, regardless of the length of time a patient has been drinking overall. In addition, alcohol withdrawal symptoms may also contribute, such as a loss of potassium with vomiting or diarrhea. It's important to replace electrolytes as needed, especially the potassium and magnesium essential to normal cardiac function. Chronic alcohol consumption leads to increased lipogenesis, or creation of fat from other products in the liver, and less use of liver fatty acids, often leading to alcoholic fatty liver or steatosis. Metabolism byproducts of alcohol inhibit the breakdown of fat or lipolysis in the liver. When a person withdraws the normal hormonal stress response, an increase in the body's release of norepinephrine and cortisol amplifies the body's response to fasting that usually coexists with alcoholism. Patients often become hypoglycemic with a sudden cessation of their only caloric intake. Stress hormone release results in decreased sensitivity to insulin, increased glucagon release, and gluconeogenesis, or the breakdown of fats, proteins, and other substances to create glucose for the immediate needs of the body. The alcohol metabolism byproducts are no longer present to prevent this process. If you remember, there is an abundance of fat. When fat is broken to glucose, ketones are a byproduct, putting withdrawing patients at risk for alcoholic ketoacidosis. While they may present with severe acidosis, unlike diabetic ketoacidosis, they will often remain alert and lucid. Diabetic ketoacidosis results in osmotic diuresis and severe dehydration that is not present to the same degree in alcoholic ketoacidosis. Symptoms include nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, increased respiratory rate, dehydration, hepatitis, pancreatitis, along with the usual symptoms of withdrawal. The body's response to the acidosis may mask hypokalemia or hypophosphatemia. Severe ketoacidosis is rare with ethanol withdrawal, and if present, it should prompt consideration of intoxication with other forms of alcohol, such as methanol or ethylene glycol, common ingredients of antifreeze and fuels, or polyethylene glycol, a chemical byproduct that can build up in the body with heavy benzodiazepine use. Alcohol withdrawal seizures occur most likely because of the imbalance of excitatory and inhibitory stimulation in the CNS. They can occur as early as hours after the last drink or as far out as 48 hours. Interestingly, typical anticonvulsants such as phenytoin do not work to control these types of seizures. Benzodiazepines, barbiturates, and even carbamazepine have all been used to control alcohol withdrawal seizures with very similar efficacy. Carbamazepine may cause dizziness and nausea, but does not have the side effects of sedation, memory impairment, and respiratory depression as the other two classes do, and also has no potential for abuse. Unfortunately, there is very little research to help guide anticonvulsant therapy. Benzodiazepines are still first-line therapy in the acute setting, and seizure prophylaxis is not recommended. So to wrap things up, alcoholism must first be recognized as a medical condition or disease. Sudden cessation causes an actual storm of excitotoxicity within the brain. Withdrawing patients will have a stress response with norepinephrine and cortisol release. They will be immunosuppressed and at high risk for aspiration. The process of withdrawal will take away from their ability to heal from other conditions. Whenever possible, the decision to withdraw a patient should be an informed decision based on risks and benefits. Once made, symptom-triggered dosing of medications is the best supported method. Benzodiazepines are first line and always primary. No other medication for withdrawal has been consistently and successfully used as anything other than an adjunctive treatment. Adjunctive medications with good support in the literature include phenobarbital and clonidine or beta blockers for sympathetic symptoms, but not withdrawal itself. Newer, up-and-coming medications used for this indication include dexmedetomidine and baclofen. Therapies for with poor support or showing actual harm with use include propofol, haloperidol, and alcohol. Unfortunately, there is a paucity of good clinical information to guide us in the treatment of alcohol withdrawal syndrome. Please leave any comments or questions on the website, and thanks for listening.